Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Up first is Australian singing sensation Cody Simpson. He's got a lot to say about his family, music, and skyrocketing career. He also talks about the importance of social media and just how many messages he receives on a daily basis. After that, we speak with writer and producer David Nadelberg, talking about his very funny TV show called The Mortified Sessions. Communications expert Dr. Terry Flynn talks about the recent beef recall in Canada and how the whole situation could have been handled much better by XL Foods. We top things off with our music editor, Sharon Hyland.
Capture your need for sound.
We're very excited to welcome Australian singing sensation Cody Simpson to the Kelly Alexander Show. Cody has been working hard and traveling all over the world, gaining fans with his smooth vocal abilities and impressive onstage performances. He was on tour this summer with Big Time Rush and has been touring with Justin Bieber. And on top of that, he just released his new album, Paradise. Cody, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Cody, you have been super busy this year. You've been on tour with Justin Bieber, Big Time Rush. You recorded your album. You've been traveling all over the place. Has it been, you know, overwhelming for you, or is this exactly what you wanted in life?
Exactly what I wanted, you know what I mean? Like, it does get overwhelming at times, but at the end of the day, you know, I think to myself, this is what I dreamed of, and, you know, it's everything and more.
Can you explain what a typical day is like for you when you're out on tour? Because I don't think people really understand how grinding it can be.
Every day is usually different. But, yeah, like you said, you know, people really don't understand how much work goes into it behind the scenes. You know, they pretty much, they see the lights and the camera and the action, and they don't really see the hours and hours that we put in every single day, you know, behind the scenes. And it's hours and weeks and months of rehearsal and recording and all that stuff that, you know, that goes behind putting a great show together and, you know, putting a great album together. And I've been on tour for like all summer since June or July, and I'm nonstop till the end of the year, so it's really exciting. And I usually wake up in the morning and I either have, you know, a morning interview or TV show I got to do, and then I'll knock out a couple hours school, and then I'll have maybe more interviews or a little bit of recording, and then sound check, and then a meet and greet, and then the show, and then sleep, and then do it all again. It's like, it's pretty busy.
Now, are you happy that you are able to get some schoolwork done? Because I'm sure a lot of kids, you know, or teenagers like your age wouldn't even want to be bothered with school. But is it important for you to get your education even though you have a career?
It is. You know, I'm just like any other kid. Yeah, I don't really like school, honestly. It is a bit of a pain when I got to sit down after, you know, my mind being everywhere to focus on maths and like English for a couple of hours. But, you know, it's something that's important and I got to do it. I mean, I've only got, you know, a year or two left of school. So, you know, getting through it, and, you know, I've always been a pretty good student. So, yeah.
Do you miss being in a traditional school at all? Or are you quite happy to have your private tutor and get her done?
Sometimes I do, you know, just the aspect of hanging out with friends and stuff like that. And, you know, school, like the girls and all that stuff, and, you know, I do miss that a bit, but I think it's much better being able to knock it out with the tutor every day.
Now, what's it been like for you to be on tour with Justin Bieber? Are you guys friends? Do you actually look up to him? I know he's only a few years older, but he's obviously, I guess, paved the way for young guys like yourself a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we've become definitely closer, as, you know, we've only been on the road for like a week together, but, you know, he's become a mate of mine, and he's awesome and very supportive of what I do. And he got to watch my show the other night and loved it. And, I got to check out his show, which was awesome also. But he asked me to actually, I'm probably going to join him again later on in the month, and then maybe a little later on the tour as well, and come back and perform a couple more shows with him, because they've been going awesome so far. So, yeah.
Now, performing for his audience, do you feel you're picking up a lot of his fans to become your own?
Definitely. You know, I feel like after I perform, you know, I definitely pick up a lot of new fans. Obviously, you know, fans that Justin and I can share. You know what I mean? It's cool for people to be able to listen to multiple artists. You know what I mean? And to like a ton of different artists. So yeah, I mean, it's awesome that we're all just kind of a family. You know what I mean?
Now, speaking of your family, I know you're quite close to your own. What does their support mean to you and your career?
So much, you know, to have moved our whole lives from the beaches of, you know, of Australia to over to, you know, the craziness of Hollywood, and, you know, the touring life, I guess it's pretty nuts, you know what I mean? It's insane how supportive, and I couldn't really ask for a better family. My mom's standing right here and she's smiling.
That's amazing. Can you actually tell us as well how you ended up working with your managers, Matt Graham, and as well as Scooter Braun, who I know mainly manages Justin, because it seems like you've really hit upon a great partnership.
Yeah, well, Matt is with me 24/7. He's pretty much become my big brother, someone that's with me all the time, and we, you know, not only kind of hang out and, you know, do things that kind of friends do, I guess, is like he's my manager, and you know, he's 100% all about, you know, this career, you know, 24/7, which is, it's awesome to have someone that believes in you so much. And Scooter, who, you know, I see him quite often also, and it's awesome to have those two working together on what I do. It's really cool, yeah, especially because Scooter's, you know, he's got a lot of great artists on his resume right now, which is, you know, I'm definitely lucky to be one of the couple that he has.
Now, do you have a lot of say in how things are done with your career, Cody? Because I know, you know, you're not even 20 yet, but I'm assuming that you have a lot of great ideas about what you want to do with your life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even 16, so... But, you know, my managers and everyone that works with me, they always respect my ideas. And, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to what I want to do and, you know, the kind of things that I see myself, you know, pursuing in the future. And I think, you know, especially with this album that just came out, it really shows people who I am. And that was really my goal with it, was to, you know, to show people. I do a lot of pop music, but I also do a lot of songs that are very unique to me, and I just wanted to show people how, you know, hey, I'm Cody Simpson.
Fantastic. Joining us on the show is Cody Simpson. Make sure to check him out on his website, CodySimpson.com, as well as on Twitter, @CodySimpson. Now, Cody, speaking of your new album, Paradise, was it a long process to record, and how excited are you now that it's out for your fans?
Very excited. I've been working on it since, like, January, I would say, maybe since the beginning of the year. We worked on a ton of songs, and I'm finally very excited that it finally came out, and my fans, I think, were very excited too, because they were waiting patiently for a long time. You know, I'd released a lot of music previous to the album, but, you know, all the hard work and all the music and all the, you know, all the things that came before this album was all kind of leading up to Paradise, I guess. And really excited that it's finally come out, and, you know, it's awesome. My fans are loving it, and everyone that's heard it has loved it so far, so yeah.
And I hear, you know, I've been following you on Twitter, and I see a lot of posts from your fans' parents saying that they're loving the CD as well. What does it mean to you to know you not only have, like, teenage fans, but you have, you know, people in their 30s and 40s that want to listen to you?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, when I meant everyone that heard it, I really meant everyone. You know, you just mentioned that parents even liked it also, which is awesome, you know. Obviously, my fans, who are, you know, predominantly girls, love it, and also, you know, even a couple of the fellas that have heard it have loved it so far. So it's just awesome to, you know, be able to create music not only for my fans but also for a much wider audience also. And that's definitely my goal in the future, is to be able to create music for everybody.
Now, you have over 3 million Twitter followers. Is it crazy for you to see all these tweets coming in? Do you ever get to sleep?
Yeah, I do get to sleep, but tweets come through literally hundreds and hundreds every minute. So it's like, you know, I don't want to have my fans get upset if I don't see their tweet, but there are tons that come through. So I try to reply and, like, retweet people as much as I can, but it is hard to kind of see everybody. But I do my best. Yeah, I think it's really important that I always, you know, I'm online and connecting to my fans, and, you know, I want to make sure they feel close to me, and, you know, that's kind of my goal.
What's the best thing about being Cody Simpson?
The best thing about being me. being able to travel the world, I would say, being able to see time in different places, being able to do what I love to do every day, you know, waking up in the morning and knowing that I'm going to change people's, you know, make people's days and, you know, even make people's years today, you know what I mean, just by giving them a hug or seeing, you know, having them come to my concerts and stuff. You know, it's awesome to be able to inspire people and create moments every day.
Would you ever want to start your own record label and manage other acts, or do you think you'll always want to be, you know, the artist in front of people?
Well, right now, obviously, I just released my first album, so I got a lot ahead of me as my own artist. But you never know in the future. You know, I'm always looking for new opportunities and, you know, new things to branch out into in the future. But, you know, right now, it's like I'm still 15. I can't drive yet. I'm just taking everything one step at a time, and I don't want to rush things. You know, I'm still pretty young, so we'll see what happens. Yeah.
Do you want to get into movies and television? Like, do you admire someone like a Justin Timberlake who, you know, started out in music, continues to do music here and there, and then has gone into other, you know, avenues?
I very much admire him. Yeah, he's one of my biggest influences, if not my biggest, you know, all around when it comes to entertainment and just himself as a person and everything that, you know, that he's done and that he's accomplished, from being, you know, a child star and to being in a boy band to being a successful solo artist, and now he's an actor. It's like, okay, that's incredible, you know what I mean? It's something that I'd love to emulate, and obviously in my own way, but it's just awesome how much he's done, and I admire that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Cody, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really, really appreciate your time. That's artist and entertainer Cody Simpson, and make sure to check him out, CodySimpson.com, as well as on Twitter, @CodySimpson.
G'day, this is Cody Simpson, and you're hanging out with Kelly Alexander on KellyAlexanderShow.com.
If you ever need to cry, the tears right from your eyes. Oh yes, I will. If you can't fall asleep at night, I'll sing to you a lullaby. Oh yes, I will. Can I be a gentleman? I'll be as gentle as I can. Girl, what will it take to be your gentleman? I'll be the luckiest man if I could be your gentleman. I wanna be the one you hug when the world is just too much. Oh, what you say? I wanna be the one you trust. I'll keep your secrets between us. Oh, what you say? Be your gentleman. I'll be as gentle as I can. Girl, what would it take to be your gentleman? I swear I'll be the luckiest man if I could be your gentleman. Yeah, I will open every door for you, 'cause my lady should be first. Possibly that you might consider me. Just say you will, and I love you humbly. I just pray that you believe that I could be a gentleman.
David Nadelberg is a writer and producer and the mastermind behind the Mortified Sessions. Since 2002, he has sifted through hundreds of journals and heard many personal stories belonging to complete strangers. David then managed to take these stories and journals and edit them into a very funny endeavor known as the Mortified Sessions, which also includes stories from famous celebrities. David, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, thanks, Kelly.
So to start off, Dave, what actually prompted you to create the Mortified Project? Like, how did this all get started?
So 10 years ago, I started a stage show where I've encouraged people to get behind a mic and share their most embarrassing childhood writings with total strangers. And all of that is because I had discovered a love letter that I wrote to a girl when I was in high school. I found that in my adult years. And it was just when I found this love letter, it was just ridiculous and it was embarrassing. And I, for whatever weird, strange reason inside me, decided I wanted to share it with friends. And then that led to strangers, and that led to me inviting other people to do the same. And then, you know, about a year and a half ago, we started doing this television show for the Sundance Channel where I started doing that with celebrities.
Now, when you were sort of unearthing these childhood memories, did you know intrinsically that they were going to be funny, or did it all have to sort of come together organically?
No, I knew that these were funny. I knew that it's you know, when you look at old photographs, you can't help but smile. You can't help but laugh. I'm sure you've dug up some things from your own past and sort of had these weird little bedroom excavations where you find something from your past, right?
Yes, sir.
And did you find, like, old writings or old photographs? Or, I mean, were you a kid who kept a diary?
It was more, there were some photographs. I wasn't a huge picture taker, but I have some pictures that were taken in high school, and I questioned my fashion sense on occasion.
You weren't a huge picture taker?
No, I wasn't, actually, but I ended up getting some, you know, from friends or whatever that were, and so, I got copies or whatever, and, yeah, I questioned my fashion sense, particularly around grade 8 and grade 9. That was a little enjoyable. and then also it was interesting to see back how crazy in love with music I was, but obviously that's still sort of the same path today. So it wasn't embarrassing. It was just funny to see how intensely personal I made it. Like, it was like, oh my God, I'm in love with Janet Jackson. It was pretty funny.
Right. And that's what our TV show captures. You know, we had a recent episode where the actor Jason Ritter, who's on the show Parenthood, you know, he had shared a bunch of diaries where that revealed his intense obsession with Kurt Cobain. And we had Gillian Jacobs from the TV show Community, where she talks about her intense obsession with Cole Porter, which I think is very weird for a girl who grew up in the 80s and 90s. But it's really these diary entries, these love letters, these poems and photographs, they're really interesting gateways into finding out about who people are. Who, and as I look at it, they just happen to be famous. But I think the appeal of the show is just sort of getting to hang out with people. Like, that's really the vibe of it. It's really a very casual, laid-back conversation.
And David, why do you think people actually want to share their stories to complete strangers? Because, you know, I don't think I would really... I suppose it would be funny to share some of these pictures of myself looking ridiculous in grade 9, but it has to be a stretch for some people. So why do you think they do it? Is it, like, cathartic?
I think for the personality types that are into it, I think there's sort of a celebration of that kid. Like, it's fun to make fun of that kid, but at the same time, you're really honoring that kid. This kid who really had a hard time. You know, I don't care how popular you were or how nerdy you may have been. We all really struggled when we were in our adolescence, and I think it's nice for us to kind of pay homage to the, you know, that teen angst warrior that we used to be, who survived.
Right. And did you ever think that you would get such a positive response from, you know, fans, and then that this endeavor that you were doing would not, you know, just stay with television, that it's expanded into all kinds of things like books and the stage show?
Yeah, I mean, although it's the reverse, it's actually started as a stage show and became a television show. But yeah, I had no idea 10 years ago when I began the Mortified Project that I would be doing this, that I would spend most of my adult life immersed in other people's childhoods, let alone that would lead to doing a television show with Sundance Channel where I'm suddenly on camera. But I think it's really exciting, you know, when you find something that speaks to people and just sort of strikes that chord. And I think that's what's happened with Mortified and now the Mortified Sessions.
Joining us on the show is David Nadelberg, author and creator of the Mortified Sessions. Make sure to check them out, getmortified.com. David, can you explain the process, I guess, you know, from getting these stories or pictures from people and then sort of crafting it and putting it out there? Because I'm assuming there's sort of like a journey.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the television show, the TV show we do, I'm not crafting anything. It's really an interview. So I sit down with celebrities, and they share their most embarrassing childhood artifacts with me. And then that just really sparks a conversation about, did I say conversation correctly? I think I did not. but it sparks a conversation about who you were and how that shaped who you became. And in the case of somebody who's, you know, become a successful actor or musician or, you know, and that tends to be the world that we delve into on the Mortified Sessions, it's really interesting to see where the DNA of that came from. Like, were you always an outgoing kid? Were you always an artistic kid? I love, you know, finding out that the answer is often no. That people sort of, different things in life happen to lead them to the path that they are on today.
Are you surprised how willing celebrities are to put it all out there? Because I know in this day and age, you know, so much of their privacy is taken away from them. And now it just seems like in this regard, they're willing to want to share it.
We're sort of the type of show that confuses the hell out of every publicist. Because they're like, I don't want my client to be involved with something that is embarrassing. But it really is, there's something really winning and redeeming, I think, about sharing your past in this way. And I think the celebrities who do participate recognize that. And not everybody is into something like this in terms of sharing. I think it's something that a lot of people will want to watch, but it's not for everyone to share. And, you know, some people are just intensely, intensely private people. But, you know, and I've met celebrities who are like, oh, my God, I love watching your show. I could never do it. And that's fine. And then I meet people who are like, oh, my God, I would totally love to do this because it's fun. It's like you're not sitting on a couch with a talk show host who's asking you about, like, what is George Clooney's on-set pranks like? You know, they've answered that kind of stuff 1,000 times. And here they're getting to have a conversation that's real, that is treating them like people, as opposed to fawning over them like celebrities. And I think that is refreshing for them.
Do you have any celebrities on your hit list that you really want to have on?
Oh, yeah. I would love to have, you know, people like Tina Fey or Mark Zuckerberg, or, you know, I'd love to have people like Michelle Obama. Like, I'm really interested in people who sort of achieved various different things in life, you know, from a wide spectrum, whether it's business, whether it's politics, whether it's entertainment, but have really, really kind of taken their lives in pretty big directions. And I want to know where that comes from.
Now, you mentioned a couple of moments ago how certain personalities might not fit to do this, but is there like a personality, like a, you know, a celebrity who you think, you know, might not fit, but you'd like to try to crack that nut anyway? Because, like, for example, I don't know that Tommy Lee Jones would sit down and do this, but I think it'd be really interesting if he did.
He would not be my most likely candidate for a show like this. And, you know, mostly because I don't know if he's someone who would have, say, you know, would have saved anything from his past. But if he had a bunch of stuff, I would be so excited to talk to someone like that. I like that's your go-to default person? That was an interesting, specific person.
No, I just, he's just someone, I was actually recently talking about him in another interview with one of my other guests, and she's a movie critic, and she said that she's had difficulty on several occasions interviewing him, but she knows it, so when she goes in, it's not as stressful as it once was, because she knows that he's prickly. And so because she's accepted that, things just go better.
Yeah, there have been one or two people on the show that I think didn't realize necessarily what they were signing up for or whatever. And that was in season one before anyone had really seen the show. And by this point, I think everyone who participates on the show has seen it. And it's the kind of thing you're either on board or you're not. And everyone who's done the show this season has been totally on board and has been super excited to go into their closets, to find that old shoebox,
to rifle through it and share like five or six items with us on the Mortified session.
Now, season two is just sort of underway. Can you give us an example of some of the celebrities that you're going to have on so that my listeners can have a clue about what's coming up?
Yeah, we have on the first episode, we have Busy Phillips, who you probably you might know if you're a fan of Freaks and Geeks, which is my favorite show ever. But she's also famous for known for shows like Cougar Town. We have people like Gillian Jacobs from Community. We have comedians like Mark Maron and Tig Notaro, who has done a bunch of Comedy Central Presents specials, as well as This American Life. Kristen Bauer from True Blood. Matt Walsh, who's one of the founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade. He's also on the show Veep on HBO. Adam Goldberg, who you might know from Saving Private Ryan. And Mark Duplass. He's a really amazing independent filmmaker.
That's a fantastic roster that you've got going on. And I quickly wanted to talk about the books as well. You know, you put out, is it two books now? And where can people actually get a hold of these books?
We have two books, two Mortified books out. And you can find them on Amazon. You can also, if you go to getmortified.com, you can find out about all Mortified projects from the Mortified Sessions, our TV show, to our books, to our stage shows in 10 cities.
Now, are there any more avenues that you can branch out to with the Mortified Sessions? Because it seems like you've got a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the Mortified project overall has been devoted to sort of mining our past for heart and humor. And we, you know, we have lots of things in the works. We have a documentary coming out next year. We've been working on it's an independent film, and we've been working on it for a couple of years, and I'm really, really proud of it. Our partners on it are I don't know if you saw the Tribe Called Quest documentary that came out and won a lot of awards like 2 years ago, but the people who made that are our production partners on that, and I'm super excited about our upcoming documentary.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I know about the documentary. Haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I'm looking very forward to seeing that for sure. And what's going to happen with you, Dave? Like you said, you've spent so much of your adult life working on the Mortified project. Will you continue, you know, to keep going, or are there other avenues that you want to pursue as well?
I just finished writing a book, and I'm about to start. We're about to go out with that and send that around to publishers. So yeah, I've kind of took a break from writing 10 years ago to do this project, and now I'm sort of circling back. And I think learning about other people's lives in the weird way that I had through Mortified and now the Mortified Sessions has weirdly taught me a lot about storytelling and hopefully made me a better writer.
And can you just sort of leave my listeners with, you know, a thought, I guess, because I just find it really interesting how you say that, you know, going back through your life, you shouldn't be mortified, really, even though you are calling it the Mortified Sessions.
Well, I think you should be mortified, but I think you should also be celebrating that kid. I think what we do with Mortified is we try to create a tone that is laugh at but cheer for. And that's what I think when you watch, you know, season two of the Mortified Sessions, I think you'll be laughing at a lot of the sort of childhood antics that these people share, but you really wind up caring. At least for me, like, I think you wind up really getting invested in people's lives. And that's, to me, what's sort of exciting is that we get to straddle both of those worlds, the embarrassment and the victory of life.
Would you advise parents of teenagers to watch your show, too, just almost as like an educational tool for them? Because I know when I was a kid and just sort of, you know, looking back and, you know, how much I was into music and stuff, I felt like my parents didn't understand me, and it really sort of hurt me at the time. And now I feel like if they had have seen that we've all like that, they, you know, they would have gone through it, too. Like, I'm sure my dad was in love with Elvis, you know, and had he sort of channeled his inner childhood, he might have been easier on me.
We, you know, we get a lot of fans who are not just parents, but teachers and also teenagers themselves, who are fans of our books, who follow us, you know, on Twitter at Mortified. And I love hearing from teenage fans and parents who sort of see this as a real great. There's no better insight into the teenage mind. You know, I've done lectures and I've done speaking engagements. People have brought me to companies, whether it's marketing companies or sort of conferences that deal with teenagers, to talk about, you know, how teenagers think. And what I've learned is that hasn't changed depending on the generation, depending on the ethnicity, depending on the gender. A teenager is a teenager is a teenager, and they're scared and they want to be heard. And what's fun about the Mortified Sessions is that, you know, 20 years later, their words, their voice is finally being heard.
Fantastic. David, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
That's David Nadelberg, author and creator of the Mortified Sessions. Session 2 underway on the Sundance Channel. For more information, check out their website, getmortified.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Taking a look at what is going on in the world of music is our music editor, Sharon Hyland.
Well, Kel, the result of the last 2 years of relationship fun for Taylor Swift is an album called Red. Our intro to her fourth album came with the song We Are Never Getting Back Together. She's obviously adjusting just fine. This was one of four promo singles that were released to iTunes leading up to the release of this 16-song album. And more blurry lines between country music and pop stardom that seem to prove that on one hand, Taylor Swift has matured into this very capable songwriter, and on the other hand, that she might actually remain the eternal teenage girl. So not exactly the same dilemma for Will.i.am. He's not ever going to be that much of an eternal teenage girl. But at this point, we should have already had his fourth project outside of the Black Eyed Peas. From March to May to now October, and now we'll have to wait until December to hear more from Willpower, the album title that's preceded with a hashtag. I think it should have been preceded with a this is gonna be late warning. As far as waiting goes, the 20th album from Kiss suffered some delays too, but now Monster has been released. Hell or Hallelujah was the intro to what the diehards are swooning over, claiming, no, really, it's really good. Yeah, no doubt. Paul Stanley has described the album as a combination of Destroyer, Revenge, and Sonic Boom, actually telling Classic Rock magazine that, quote, it's like Sonic Boom on steroids, end quote. So this from the man with the pucker, that means it's going to be some heavy Kiss. And it's been a busy time for Neil Young, whose book Waging Heavy Peace is on shelves, concert DVD Journeys is out, and who with Crazy Horse Unleash Psychedelic Pill. This is a heads up. Putting the word psychedelic in the title should be fair warning that there are some long songs on this album. Rock fans will find a great read in Pete Townsend's autobiography. The Who guitar god and singer-songwriter shares his story in Who Am I? Rod Stewart's written one too. Rod, the autobiography, will undoubtedly rub in the notion that blondes do have more fun, even when they get too old to be dating those younger blondes. Rod. The book will get us primed for the end of the month release of Merry Christmas, Baby. This is produced by David Foster and will be Rod Stewart's first Christmas album. And no, I can't believe I mentioned Christmas either. Halloween hasn't even happened yet. Until next time, when the wait on that new Aerosmith will have ended, finally, we'll be into round 2 of 3 of those cleverly titled Green Day albums and 16 years later for Soundgarden. See you then.
If you love it like I love it, and you feel what I feel inside, if you want it like I want it, then baby, let's get it tonight. If you feel it, say hey. Notes on a sheet, the dope crusader, funky terminator. I created me a rocket just so we could rock it later. And the way the beat is knocking got me feeling, cause the DJ got me walking on the ceiling. I got a rocket for the globe, bomb it just go. Fill it up with love and then I watch it explode. If you love it like I love it,
and you feel what I feel inside.
Feel what I feel.
If you want it like I want it, then baby, let's get it tonight. If you feel it, say hey.
Crisis continues to unfold in Alberta, affecting Canada, the U.S., and Japan so far. With over 10 confirmed E. coli cases linked to the XL Foods plant, many questions remain surrounding the investigation. Discussing the XL Foods beef recall and the controversy surrounding it is Dr. Terry Flynn, an active teacher and researcher in public relations, crisis communications, and reputation management. Dr. Flynn is experienced in the specific issues at play, having worked with the town of Walkerton during an E. coli crisis at Maple Leaf Foods. Dr. Flynn, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you, Kelly.
Now, in your opinion, why do you think it took about 2 weeks before the Canadian Food Inspection Agency started issuing public safety hazard warnings to the public?
Well, their first notice that there was something wrong was actually an indication from a U.S. inspector on September 3rd. Most of the products that are produced in the plant actually are exported back into the United States. And it was one of those U.S. inspectors that identified E. coli in one of the shipments. So they notified the CFIA on September 4th, and that process then began to unfold. Why they didn't do something until mid-September, I think that would be a good subject for some kind of inquiry to figure out why this is. You know, in essence, Canadians have been kept in the dark by both the government and by this company on what was happening. It took the government till September 27th, really, to close the plant down because of safety concerns. And at this point in time, in your introduction, they said 10 confirmed cases. Well, that's actually up to 12 now, with the bulk of those, 7 of those 12 in Alberta, 3 of them in Quebec, and 1 each in Newfoundland and BC. But this is the antithesis to the kind of expectations that Canadians have of corporations in terms of communicating during a crisis, to sort of pull behind the screen and not communicate, only be forced to communicate, and then communicate in text only, really doesn't provide a great deal of comfort to Canadians who might be concerned about their health at this time.
Now, if I understand things correctly, you know, the U.S. continuously sort of came back to the CFIA, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, you know, with this beef that had tested positive for E. coli, and then it eventually closed the border to beef products from XL Foods before the recall was actually made in Canada. So how disastrous was this for the CFIA's reputation?
Well, I think it has an impact across the board, not just the CFIA. I mean, there are a government agency that is trying to enact the government's will. It's my understanding the government has actually decreased the number of inspectors at plants such as the XL one. So they're trying to do the best job that they can. What you want to do is be able to question to what extent did the government and the minister have wind of this, and was there any discussions in between the identification of the positive findings and the eventual public warnings between the CFIA and the minister's office and beef industry officials, especially at the plant. So what was happening in that period of time to discuss, because in essence what it is how they position it, is a voluntary recall. And at that point, remember, the plant is not shut down. They had identified a period at the end of August and early September where the meat products could have been contaminated. But what was happening behind the scenes at this time? And why wasn't anybody taking the positive step to notify the public? So those are the kind of questions I think the public have to ask and perhaps need to continue to be asked by investigators.
Who do you point the finger at, I guess, in regards to, it just seems like shady business practices, like you know, who in
you
charge
didn't
of...
You say shady, right?
Yeah, I said shady, yeah.
When we're talking E. coli, those other words come up too.
Exactly. And I just was wondering, like, you know, does management at XL, like, you know, are they going to have a hard look at themselves? Is anyone going to get fired?
Well, at the end of the day, this is a private corporation that is producing one-third of the red meat in Canada. And it's their operations that are under review and are closed down at this point in time. So really, the crosshairs really aim at the Nielsen brothers, the owners of the XL company, and how they operate. And you know, it's my understanding that today there will be an update by the CFIA with respect to the investigations that have been going on in the plant over the last 2 days to see whether or not, I guess, they're ready to be opened. But, you know, the public have little say here. It's not like a branded company that you can go out and boycott their products, because we don't know in many cases where these products are being consumed or who's repackaging them or who's distributing them. So I think Canadians have to be a little bit more vigilant in asking at their local grocery stores or in their meat products, you know, is this meat safe? Is it produced by XL? And until they get the all clear and they reassure Canadians that, in fact, their products are safe, I think Canadians are going to be a little reluctant to consume beef that they don't know the original origins of that product.
Joining us on the show is crisis communications expert Dr. Terry Flynn. You can follow him on Twitter at Terry Flynn or his blog page terryflynn.ca. Now, what kind of effect do you think that this recall is going to have on Canadians, you know, consuming beef again? I mean, I know everyone's consuming it, you know, as days go by, but do you think it's making people think twice?
Well, I think there's, you know, with every crisis, there's an opportunity, and you have to look at the opportunity for alternative choices, so other protein sources that Canadians might want to consume. They might, in fact, have a choice of going to local butchers rather than purchasing meat at big box stores where they don't know where the product originated from. So, you know, if I want to purchase products that I believe are safe, if I'm going to go into a local butcher store and say, you know, tell me where it's from, how can you guarantee that this product is safe? You know, the big issue for consumers, I think, is the confidence in the beef supply. So it's incumbent upon not only XL but also the Canadian Beef Association to talk about how their products are safe and how consumers will be consuming safe product in the near future. So I think there's a lot of communications efforts have to go on because this company failed in its obligation, societal obligation, to be a communicative actor in this crisis.
Has this recall really affected Canadian beef distribution in other countries?
Well, sure it has. I mean, it's we don't need much of a scare to close the border. The border into the United States is a very, very heavily regulated border. So there's a great deal of economic pressures to make sure that the Canadian beef industry doesn't have an unfair advantage. So they're going to have to work very hard to get that border reopened. Now, markets that are further away, because this plant, while it's large in Canadian perspective, producing one-third of all beef products in Canada, it probably only represents about 3 to 4% of all meat produced in North America and maybe about 0.2% worldwide. So the farther we get away from Alberta and Canada, it's not going to have that much impact, but it all depends on the severity of the regulation in those countries to ensure that that meat coming from that facility and Canada is safe.
At what point do you think that XL Foods, you know, should have come out and made a statement to the public? Because it just seems they really did not handle this well at all.
That might be an understatement, Kelly. I think this is, you know, the good news is I get to teach the maple leaf case study to my crisis classes, and now I get to actually teach the antithesis. And I think what is so surprising in this era of increasing transparency and availability to news every moment of every day through social media, that this company has taken almost a 1950s approach to communications. You know, we're not going to talk, and we're only talk when we're forced to talk, and when we do talk, we'll limit how we do engage, and we will not at all send up anybody to go and talk on behalf of the organization. You know, Canadians don't know the face behind the Nielsen brothers that are the co-CEOs of this family, or this family business. So, you know, why is it? You know, some people say, well, they're a private company, so they don't have to, you know, or they're not a branded company, so they don't have to. But I take the opposite approach. I said, you know, when the public gives you the license to operate, and in fact, when it's an organization or an industry that whose product is all based on trust, we as consumers must trust that that food is safe to consume it, then they have a moral obligation to, in fact, be communicative, to be able to tell Canadians what has happened, why it's happened, and what they're going to do to ensure that that product is safe. And we don't have to look that far back 4 years ago with Michael McCain, who did that in a very strategic and transparent way. And as a result, not only has become the gold standard in terms of communicative behavior in crisis, but during that period of 2008 and 2009, actually increased their reputation capital and market value during that crisis.
Now, we both know that, you know, XL Foods has made so many mistakes regarding this situation. Has their biggest mistake been that they haven't communicated properly?
Well, I think their biggest mistake is that they've run a very poor operation. Number one, that they've allowed contaminated products to get into the food supply. So that's their number one mistake. The second mistake is making the assumption that they don't have to communicate, that they don't have to get out ahead of this. So I think both those together, operational failure and communication failure, has put them on the front lines and has continued this story well beyond probably what it has needs to happen. Food recalls, car recalls happen every day. You know, Toyota just announced one of the largest recalls of their automobiles just yesterday. And Toyota is a learning organization, so they've said that they've learned from what happened in 2010. But here's a company that just seemingly either has no idea about how to communicate or how to effectively manage or how to treat their employees properly. And so now you have to question the entire operations of the firm. Do they know what they're doing in producing this meat? So those are the kind of questions that consumers will have until the company, in fact, faces up.
Now, here's the deal. I work quite a bit in the entertainment side of things with celebrities and all that sort of stuff, and I know how much or how important social media plays for them, whether they're trying to promote, you know, their new project or they have a scandal and they're trying to deal with it. But when it comes to big business like this, how important of a role does social media play when it comes to crisis management, you know, in a situation like this beef recall?
Well, I think we have to sort of dissect that question into a couple of publics. So from a media standpoint, social media now is the connection between organizations and media organizations. You know, that most journalists that I know have are involved in social media, very heavy users of social media. And so if you want to connect with them or keep them up to speed, you want to be able to interact with them. You also, from a social media standpoint, want to know what people are talking about. How's the conversation? What's the tone of the debate that's going on, or the tone of the discussion? So they're not players at all in any of these fronts. And in fact, the only communication that we've seen, their news releases are not even posted on their website. There's one little button about food recall. It links to a document that was posted more than 3 weeks ago. But these news releases that they're sending out to Canada Newswire aren't even linked to their website. So you just have to shake your head and say, well, you know, maybe they don't have the internet up there where they are at XL.
Do you think that what has gone on with XL is making other people in this business, or just in business in general, take a second look at how they can handle their own situations should something happen like this?
Well, you know, a crisis is always a good way to ready the mind and ready the mindset of the organization. So I'm sure a lot of organizations are now having that discussion with their communicators and their risk managers and their operators and saying, look, are we ready? If something were to happen to us, how quickly could we engage in a communicative behavior so that we don't lose reputation capital, that we, in fact, try to manage as effectively as we can the communications agenda? And then, more importantly, you know, a crisis impacts the organization's ability to efficiently and effectively achieve its mission. So the number one objective when you have a crisis is to get back up in business as quickly as possible. And obviously, this organization, not only because they failed operationally, but they failed communicatively, are now going to be held hostage, in many cases, to public will and government politics in terms of how soon they'll be allowed to get back up to operate. Because what the government doesn't want is that this becomes their crisis. As soon as the government gives the A-OK that this facility is safe to open, then Canadians will turn to the government the next time that, in fact, they have to close down.
Do you think that there should be more Canadian Food Inspection Agency inspectors in these types of plants?
Well, that's beyond my specific area of expertise, but it does give us a sense that when we only have between 20 and 40 inspectors a day and 4,000 cattle are being processed each and every day, then an inspector really has a very short period of time to investigate. And I guess they play a secondary role to the primary role of the company itself. So they're not there inspecting every piece. They're only there as a safety valve. And obviously, it didn't work in this case.
If you were sitting down right now with the Nielsen brothers, what are the first three things you would tell them to do to fix this?
We have to talk. We have to talk. And we have to talk. Meaning we have to communicate to the public, we have to communicate to our suppliers, and we have to communicate to the government. And whether you're reluctant or not, we have to, in fact, find a venue for Canadians to get to know you. And I would select one outlet, and I would probably select somebody that has national prominence, somebody that can give us good reach, that it would be, in some respects, perhaps not an easy interview, but perhaps a safe interview. And that's the way I would get them into this. Throwing them in front of a horde of reporters at this point in time probably paralyzed them and not be an effective way of addressing the issue of lack of communication. So I remember that what happened to us in Walkerton when we held a national news conference, and we had to put the mayor and the chair of the PUC, Public Utilities Corporation, in front of about 100 media people. And they said, well, we don't want to do it. And I said, well, we don't have any choice. And we have an obligation to answer the questions that Canadians have about the safety of their water system here.
Now, obviously, the situation is happening here in Canada. Do you think other countries around the world are paying attention to this, though, again, to maybe say, hey, we're not ready for this either?
Sure, we'd like to think that, but probably not. What happens in Canada doesn't have a significant influence around the world. And E. coli beef recalls happen on a regular basis in the United States. It's something that, you know, these are large-scale manufacturing facilities that seem to have to deal with this or battle with E. coli contamination on an ongoing basis. So I think wise and smart business leaders are asking themselves the question, are we ready? To what degree will we be able to hold the standard that has Canadians have placed on organizations? And what do we need in the event that we do have a gap between what the expectations are and our ability to deliver? How are we going to resolve that gap?
And my last question would be just regarding consumers. You know, it seems like we have no say in any of this. Is there anything that we as consumers can do in a situation like this?
Well, sure we do. I think consumers have the ultimate choice. You can stop eating these products. You can use social media to express your opinion. You can start a website. You can talk to your politicians and regulators and try to get them. But it means that you have to actually get involved. You get engaged, and you have to be an active consumer and an active citizen to invoke change in these kind of issues.
Fantastic. Dr. Flynn, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Kelly, thank you very much.
That's crisis communications expert Dr. Terry Flynn. Follow him on Twitter at Terry Flynn, his blog page terryflynn.ca.
Capture your need for sound.
As always, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Cody Simpson, David Nadelberg, as well as Dr. Terry Flynn, and our music editor, Sharon Hyland. I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Michelangelo. The greater danger for most of us lies not in setting our aim too high and falling short, but in setting our aim too low and achieving our mark. Now, next week on the show, we've got a lot going on, lots of important topics, including cyberbullying, as well as invasive questions being asked during your job search. That's a big no-no. We also chat with Dr. Samantha King about the Pink Ribbon Campaigns for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which, as you know, happened throughout the month of October. Please don't forget to check out our Twitter, at K Alexander Show. We've got a lot going on there, lots of updates. Also on Facebook, Kelly Alexander Show, and our celebrity interviews, all posted now on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. If you have any comments or questions, don't be shy. Drop me a line, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.